A teacher in psychology. She taught her this unit, and she thought she nailed it really well, so she issued an exit ticket. It was a verbal one. She asked the class this question. She said, a man gets up suddenly from his chair, throwing his arms all over and ranting and raving for no apparent reason. And then the next moment, he's back at his chair, hands, arms on his knees, hands, head in his hands, and he's weeping uncontrollably. Again, no apparent reason. So the psychology teacher says, what would you call him?
A football fan.
No. A basketball coach. So, and with that, I will tell you that we tried to get speaker this week, and every time I contacted one of five or six people, they took a while to get back to me. And then the last person I contacted, I was assured he would definitely come. But by Tuesday this week, I figured out he probably won't be here, and so I had to say, yes, God, I will share what you've been laying on my heart. Not that I'm anxious to, but because you told me to. So that's what we're going to do today. I'm going to share with you what God has been sharing with me. I hope that, therefore, that you understand that I'm not necessarily up here by my own choice, but because God has told me to be. So make sure that you hang up your cell phones, put aside your plans for the afternoon, hang on, pay attention, be present, because my hope is God is speaking to not just me, but to all of us. So, before I get started, though, I do want to talk a little bit about me. Most of you know me, but I'm going to give you a little bit of background. I grew up here in Dayton most of my life. I was a latecomer. I came in second grade, so I was a really latecomer. And was saved mostly through the witness of Ed and Beth at the age of 16. And that changed my life significantly, realizing that God loved me, that God loved me enough to have died for me. To love me enough that not only did he die for me, he's providing a place for me to be, and he's providing for me now, here, today. I went on and I got married at 19, which some people would say is really crazy, but thank God I found the right gal, and actually this past week we celebrated our 43rd anniversary. Don't do the addition, I will tell you I'm 62. So, what I went on, I started, my working career has been a really odd one. I worked at the nursery for a while and farming for a while, went into construction and worked in a mobile home factory, and then I went back to school for 7 years. Graduated from school in the middle of a recession and wasn't able to get work as an engineer for a while, so I went back to construction, among other things. But all along, God did provide, and then I eventually got a job in electronics. And then as an electrical design engineer, which is what I did up until the time when I actually quit for a while. And now, praise God, I went back to the classroom. And it's been wonderful because it's an opportunity to share with kids that are broken. Not just kids, not just to share knowledge with them, but to share my life with them, to affect them for positive change. And I don't see any finer place to be at this point in my life than to be able to reach out to young people and to affect them for the long term. So, that's my adult life, but I don't think that's really enough to explain totally who I am and what I am. So I got to tell you that I'm a broken person, wounded, and I'm from a broken family of members who were and are broken and wounded. And I believe we're all in that position. I believe that we all have a brokenness within us that God only can provide. I'll go on to explain a little bit about my brokenness and those of my sisters. Not to a great deal, but my mom and pa and really my dad as well stopped parenting us, the girls and I, when we were very, very young. When I say stop parenting, my mom had mental illness that for years went undiagnosed and untreated. And she would often abandon us during the day, close herself in her room with the curtains drawn. It would be totally dark, and we would hear the TV going, and occasionally she would be responding or yelling at some voice in the darkness somewhere. And this started happening when we were fairly young. And when I was, Chris, if your memory is probably better than mine, but when I was six, maybe seven, my parents started a routine that lasted basically the rest of both their lives, and which they left us, the three of us, the kids, home, alone, with no supervision. Again, I was the oldest, I was seven, I was in charge of my two younger sisters, and at the time I believe they were 5 and 3. They went to Portland, while we stayed home. And this happened regularly, continually. I got to a point where at times, it was 3 and 4 times a week. And my mom was thrilled when I got my license, or at least got old enough to drive, because that meant that she didn't have to drive herself up to Portland to meet my father, or have him come back down to pick her up, only to turn around and go back to Portland. I could take her. This is great, especially when the fact is that I drove for a couple months without a license back and forth to Portland, because she was so desperate to get to Portland and away from her home that she didn't care what the state inspector said when he flunked me the first time I took the test. She said, "What do they know? You're a good driver." And off I went. But that's not the first time she'd done that. They'd also took a week of time in Atlanta, leaving me home with the girls and the keys. So we had some good times racing up and down some of the back roads. And, it wasn't easy, and some kids at that time might have been envious because we were basically left to raise ourselves, with me being the more responsible one, supposedly. Thankfully, we never burned anything down. We may have come close, but we didn't burn anything down. None of us got wounded. I did escape a bat that Chris took after with me, and I had escaped a wooden pail that my other sister threw at me, but other than that, there were no real incidences. And see, where's my dad in the middle of all this? Well, my dad was a brilliant person. He was smart, but he was also wounded. He was pleasant to be around, but he kept his distance from people. He never had any close friends. We never, except for a couple relatives, we never had anybody come to our house during the time I was growing up. He worked a lot, probably as an escape to get away from the family and other responsibilities at home. And he concentrated all of his efforts on my mother, who again was left undiagnosed and out of control, and he followed right down that same path with her, being pulled, if you will, by her. Instead of taking charge, he rather sat back and just tried to keep her satisfied and quiet. Again, I was a responsible one for that time. And I am not in any way going through a pity party. I just want to explain a little bit about the background here, because I know that there are others that have had it bad and probably worse. As far as the farm was concerned, I was also responsible for the farm growing up. The first time I drove a tractor, I was probably between 7 and 8. And from that point on, I'd spend my hours after school on the tractor or the combine. During the summertime, I'd be combining. And mind you, these equipment that I ran had an option for a battery, but my dad was too cheap to buy batteries, so I had to hand crank those son of a guns. And I swear the flywheel on those things outweighed me by quite a bit, but we got it done. So, why am I sharing all this? Well, because it explains a lot of who I am today. It's shaped me. It's made me a person who takes responsibility seriously, but is also wounded to the point where it's often tough, difficult to actually accomplish the things I set out to do. I make commitments that are over, sometimes I'm overcommitted because I'm a people pleaser. I tried to very hard during the time growing up to please my father in particular, who had lacked the capacity to share his approval. To actually, I never remember ever hearing from either of our parents that they loved us, nor do I ever remember receiving any accolades from either one. But I still sought that approval through overaccomplishment, if you will, because I equated love to being receiving praise or to receive some kind of thanks. And I got it from other people and other things. And I'm still a people pleaser today. I'm still a workaholic at times, although I'm recovering with my wife's help. But as a result of my upbringing, I am also prone to manic depression at times. It's sometimes just plain old standard depression. I haven't had a manic depression episode for a long time, but I still get depression. But I do know the despair of having your personal Titanic strike an iceberg and sink down into the depths of the cold, dark Atlantic, and never to see daylight, or feeling that you'll never see daylight again. And I don't think I'm alone. I think a lot of people may experience the same thing. I will also tell you that I've also experienced the joy of being raised out of those depths, to raise to heights to where I can worship God for who he is and the marvelous love that he has for us, to know him personally and to feel him within my heart, to feel his direction within my life, feel him using me to affect other people's lives. But sometimes I still go into those depression modes. I still have cloudy days occasionally. I still have days where I just feel incapable of feeling anything. I still have those times where I want to please everyone, and when I can't, it affects me deeply. I still have those days when I look to others for approval and love, and not God. Again, I don't think I'm alone. I think that other people suffer from the similar, maybe not the same, but similar effects. You see, we are people marvelously built by God, made by in His image. And we have the capability of doing great and marvelous things. But the higher those heights of accomplishment, the lower the valleys are between those heights. And we see this in the Bible. We see it in Job. We see it in David. We definitely see it in David in his Psalms. If you ever have a chance to read Psalms 42 or 77, he sunk deep at times. And he rose to great heights as well. So, the key to coming out of those dark times is God. It's God. It's always God. God's the answer to everything, isn't it? Jesus is the answer. Andre Crouch said so, anyway. Jesus is the answer for the world today. But I guess, though, I look at the church, and I've got to tell you that the church, as far as I can see, and I'm including myself in that, fails people in my position and people like me miserably. Miserably. Don't understand why. Well, yes, I do. I think it's, and I'll explain. The church often people within the church will respond with condemnation at times when they feel, I'm really depressed and don't know why, I don't understand. Well, obviously you're not serving God. Boom, right between the eyes. I don't need to hear it. No one needs to hear that. They need help. You're not spiritual. You've let Jesus down because, what's the world going to think if they see an unhappy Christian? They are going, they're not going to be attracted to Christ if you're down, so you are a really poor representative of Christ. That's not true, guys. But we often will say that because Christians are happy. Well, are we happy all the time? Not really, not always. Or the oftentimes without condemnation, if there's condemnation isn't there, it is well-meaning little sound bites like, be of good cheer. I have come that you might have light, and you might have life more abundantly. Buck up and deal with it. Or just simply think good thoughts. That'll help. I got to tell you, when you're in the middle of those things, those times, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. Not a bit. Nor does it help, which is the other response I see oftentimes from church people, is when you're in this kind of funk. They ignore you. They just let you be. It's like their burdens are so big that they can't take the time to come alongside you because secretly they're suffering as well. And they're not willing to share that with you, nor are they willing to share your griefs. So, what results are, we have this gospel of happiness. Sometimes it's genuine. Sometimes not so much, but sometimes we will put on this face when we walk, or when we pull into the parking lot, and we are have had a lousy day. We're unwilling to share it with anybody because we feel that condemnation or those sound bites, or we're convinced that we're a failure because we should be happy. Well, this result of this is in the church, within the church, we lack connection. We lack being real at times. And it's too hard to find, and it becomes hard to maintain a facade, or hard to carry one another's burdens, and we are not close. We're not serving one another. So, I said earlier that Christ is the answer. Jesus is the answer. All right? Acknowledging that everyone has a cloudy day. Everybody has some times in their lives where there's not a happy day. It happens. Sometimes it's purely a physiological thing. Sometimes there's actually an event that happened, or an event that triggers a memory of something has happened. In my family's life, there have been tragedies, not just within my immediate family, but far distant in the past, that actually would explain a large portion of the dysfunction that my father and my mother had. But nobody acknowledged them. Nobody did anything about them. And again, my mother went undiagnosed for decades. She was just doing what she'd learned. Her parents abandoned her, basically. Their abandonment, though, was not quite the same, in that they would take her to the bar with them, and leave her outside while they were inside. So you see, my parents on my mother's side were alcoholics. My dad's father was also a person that practiced judgment and unable to feel or function or have praise. So, church, what are we to do? What are we to do about this? What should we change? Are we going to stick our head in the sand like an ostrich and just ignore the issue? I got to tell you, the image I get of that is not pretty. I mean, at least the ostrich has some plumage to cover their backsides. So, you know, are we to pretend nothing happened? Pretend that everything is just beautiful? I don't know. But I think God has, there's pictures all over the Bible of beautiful pictures of what God would do. And I think that's how we should respond. It's how God would respond. Don't you think? So, I invite you, if you have a Bible, to turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. Let's look at it. 1 Kings chapter 19. A little bit of background. This is a story of Elijah. Not Elisha, Elijah. Now, here was a man, if there was ever a man who should never have suffered any kind of depression, this is your man. He listened to God and he followed his voice unwaveringly. He was told by God to speak to Ahab and to rebuke him. He did. He was told by God to pronounce that there would be no rain, and there was not a single drop for 3 years. He was sought out by Ahab and his armies to kill him, basically, and God protected him during that time. He lived with a widow who God miraculously extended their food supply to a point where it lasted for years while others were starving around them. He raised a person from the dead. And then God tells him to go and confront Ahab. So he goes to confront Ahab, and he meets Baal's prophets at Mount Carmel. Have you ever read that story? Amazing. Amazing story. He faces all these hundreds of priests of Balaam or Baal, and he says, okay, let's build an altar. I'll give you your choice of oxen. They took their choice of oxen. He said, okay, now build an altar and call down fire. This thing will start on its own, right? If your God is truly God, it'll start on its own. I will prepare an altar on my side. One against, I think, 400. It might have been more, it might have been less. I don't, but it was quite a few. They prayed and they danced and they carried on for half a day anyway. They cut themselves, they did everything they could. No answer, no response. So what did Elijah do? He says, bring me some water. So they poured water all over that altar, not once, but twice. And then he just simply says the word, God, bring fire down from heaven. And that thing ignited and consumed not just the offering and the wood, but also the water. It consumed it all. And then he goes and he prays that the rain would return immediately following that. And here out in the distance, after seven times of checking, there's a small, tiny little cloud, and he says, rain's coming, and let's go warn Ahab. Go get your chariots ready, because the rain's coming. You better get home while you still can. And so Ahab loads up his chariot and takes off, and Elijah, through the power of the Lord, outran Ahab with his chariot back to the city. Okay, there's our backdrop. He should be triumphant. I mean, well, you would think, right? Well, what would happen to change that? Let's see. What happened? In 1 Kings 19, verse 1, it says, now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a message to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me if it be so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them. See, he had not only triumphed, he had basically put the prophets of Baal to death. And it says, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there. Wait a minute. This is the same time frame where he just conquered. He just proved that God was real. He just, in one man facing all these priests, had totally destroyed them to the point where the people were willing to kill them. And not only that, he made sure that the rain was coming. And one woman says, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you before by tomorrow. And he takes off running. He took off running. I'm sure that surprised Ahab. It surprised everyone, including Elijah. It surprised him. His response, my goodness. God is good. God is great. God is provides. And God, oh, I'm running. What is it about the power of a woman's wrath? I don't understand. But he did. And then he not only ran, but he left his servant behind. See, Elijah's quickly going toward a deep depression. and he leaves his servant behind. That is the worst thing you could possibly ever do if you ever have this kind of mode. Even though you may not feel like company, don't ever allow yourself to isolate yourself. He did. And so he takes off without the servant, running from Jezebel, one person, when he'd eluded an army of people looking for him for years. He takes off from running, and he came to, it goes on to say, well, he left his servant while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat under it, and prayed that he might die. He is miserable. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. So, he was so distraught by his reaction and the fact that he felt he had let God down him, that he was wanting to die, willing to die, right there and then. And then he falls down and goes to sleep. You see, sometimes just the littlest things can trigger a bout of depression or a bout of anything, you know, bad reaction of any sort. And his simple trigger was the fact that he ran when before he had never ran. But what did God do? What was God's reaction? What did God do with Elijah? Let's look at verse 5. He said, all at once an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. And he looked around, and there by his head was a clay cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate, drank, and then laid down again. Obviously, Elijah was exhausted, tired, hungry. And that oftentimes will bring about a depression or something similar to it. And what did God do? He provided that food, that nourishment, and that water. And which was good, because I don't believe Elijah at that point even remembered the fact that he needed to eat or to take care of himself. And oftentimes we find that people with an illness of some sort often feel the same. They don't remember. They don't simply just do not remember to take care of themselves. It happens. If we look at verses 9 and 10, it says, okay, I'm back. Start with verse 7. Then the angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up, eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up, ate, and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Oreb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. Again, God fed him. God allowed him to rest. God gave him or provided him a safety place to rest, to sleep, to regroup. What's one thing we could do as a church? Allow people the space. Allow them, you know, provide for them. Allow them to regroup. If they haven't been taking care of themselves, make sure that we understand and are able to help with that. And the food bank oftentimes has that opportunity, as well as the clothing connection, because oftentimes they forget to clothe themselves properly as well. And then in verses 9 and 10, and the word of the Lord came to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Well, God, why would he ask that? Because he knew exactly where he was. And he replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, put your prophets to death with the sword, and I am the only one left. Now, you are trying to kill me too. God allowed Elijah to vent. Sometimes that's all it needs. We don't need to offer our condemnation. We don't have to tell, you know, be of good cheer, stand up, buck up. Just allow people to vent. Allow them to understand that, you know, give them an understanding ear. God certainly did. He didn't condemn him for feeling that way. He definitely did not say, Elijah, buck up. Deal with it. He allowed him to just vent. And said, the Lord said, go out and stand on a mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. And it says, then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord, he wasn't in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in that fire. And then after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. See, oftentimes we think we're representing God when we are come at somebody that is in a powerful and a big way, and we say, this is the way it is. You need to deal with it. Get up. Represent Jesus the right way. Did God do that? Did he beat him over the head? Did he blow him away with the wind? Did he set the fires of hell on her? He did not. He spoke to him. He not only allowed him to vent, he spoke to him in gentleness. And what happens after that? Then a voice said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Again, God knew. He replied, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broke down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword, and I'm the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too. Wait a minute. He's vented again. Why would God let him vent again? He just came to him in this gentle, compassionate way, and he shouldn't expect Elijah to just respond like? No. And again, God listened, and he didn't condemn him for feeling the way he did. Not at all. Then the Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus when you get there. Guess what he did? He gave Elijah purpose. He gave him a reason. The tasks were small compared to taking on an army of priests for the opposite side or raising somebody from the dead. He was simply told to go out and meet these three individuals. So when you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimish, king over Israel, and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel Meholah, to succeed you as a prophet. He gave him a task. It was small, but it was a task. He gave him purpose. Oftentimes when you're in just that mode where you're depressed or you're just feeling anxious, it's because you don't feel you have a purpose. And in today's church, that's probably not surprising because many of us don't have a purpose. We occupy a pew and we come back the next month or next week, maybe 2 weeks later, and occupy the same pew. But God has a purpose for each and every one of us. And maybe it's small, maybe it's huge. But God has a purpose for every single one of us. And when how did God address Elisha in the middle of this funk? He first let him vent, provided food and nourishment, and let him vent again, and gave him a task. Give him a purpose. And among all that, he gave him a helper. He gave him assistance in the form of Elijah. Elijah is an interesting story, and I can't go there right now, but I wish I could because he is really an interesting character as well. But Elijah was never condemned for his attitude, never condemned for his venting, never condemned for running out after having so many successes. He was accepted from God. He was nourished by God. He was given purpose by God. And eventually, Elijah never experienced death as a servant of God. So, note, I just said he never experienced it. I did not say he was raised from the dead, because obviously he was not. But, so, what's our where's all this going? My heart is really, because I've experienced it, because I know the deep pangs of having a broken family, of having relationships that are not perfect, of having challenges in my life and the people around me. And because I feel God's touch in him wanting me to, and I believe others as well, to reach out to those people that are broken, to not to hesitate or isolate ourselves, but to be open and real with one another, to admit our failings, to forgive one another, gently minister to one another, and then send each other out to bring people. God will always provide nourishment for those who are weak and looking and seeking. God will always provide direction for those who are honestly seeking. God will always provide helper for those that are concerned about their abilities or the abilities of the church, even. He always will. So I'm encouraging people, basically this morning, to consider your own lives and the lives of people around you and how you can minister to them in that small, quiet way, how you can provide nourishment as well as direction for them, how you can introduce them to the only answer, the key, Jesus himself. I know that it made a difference in my life. Thank God for Ed and for Beth for pointing me in that direction. Thank God for a godly wife who has at times put up with some of the stuff that I had done. Thank God for the ability to rise above and to experience those times of daylight and sunshine when you've been in the gloom. And he will always provide that if you seek. Again, thank you all. And if the worship team could come forward.